Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. attack early Friday in northwest Pakistan is believed to have been CIA-directed. Missiles fired remotely from a Predator aircraft targeting very senior leaders of Al-Qaeda. At last report, 18 civilians in the village died when three houses were blown away in the night. Pakistani officials say prime target Ayman al-Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda's number two, was not among them. And Al-Qaeda's number one, Osama bin Laden, remains unseen. Gary Bernstein was CIA field commander when bin Laden escaped from Tora Bora in the Afghan War. Up next on Point, Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, and the American hunt. Joining me now from Pakistan is Financial Times reporter Farhan Bakari. He's been covering Friday's U.S. airstrikes and Pakistani response. Farhan Bakari, thank you for being with us. How is Pakistan digesting the news of the American strikes late last week?
Well, there's very widespread anger across Pakistan in the wake of this incident. Some very strange things are happening. For example, yesterday in the city of Karachi, in a public demonstration, for the first time in a very long time, people saw protesters from Islamic parties join hands with one of the parties based in Karachi, which is a supporter of President Musharraf, a party called the MQM. And these two groups do not have any history of close cooperation, but now they are together. Elsewhere in Pakistan, there's a great deal of anger and bitterness. And people are saying quite openly that this is perhaps the biggest setback to the U.S. image in Pakistan, which already has suffered quite a big bit in the wake of the occupation of Iraq. But this is clearly the biggest setback to the U.S. and its public profile in Pakistan.
Farhan, dissect that setback for us. Is it because of the civilian deaths? They were substantial in number, 18 we're now told. Was it because of defensiveness about Pakistani sovereignty and the U.S. incursion, or was it because Pakistanis do not want al-Qaeda's leaders caught?
I think it's primarily and principally the immediate issue is, of course, that these deaths appear to be largely deaths of innocent civilians, including, we are told, five or six children, at least three, maybe up to five women. So this incident for the Pakistani public seems completely futile and something that should not have taken place ever. But I think this comes in the background of a general sense of anti-Americanism and anxiety across the Islamic world, many Islamic countries, Muslim countries. People are quite resentful of the United States because they see the U.S. using the cover of the war on terror to go after various Islamic leaders and to put pressure on government to curb freedom surrounding Islamic groups and Islamic leaders, all in the name of the war on terror. I think the war on terror has probably been, the conduct of the war on terror has probably been the biggest setback to the image of the United States as far as someone of my generation can remember.
Farhan, what can you tell us about exactly what happened Friday night in northwest Pakistan, about what American intelligence officials appear to have believed was going on there, and what happened in the attack? There's now unnamed American officials saying, well, maybe al-Zawahiri was there, or at least we don't know for sure that he wasn't.
Well, that's a moot point and will remain a moot point whether al-Zawahiri was there or not. There are people here who are saying that the U.S. would not have taken this major step, would not have gone for these airstrikes if the information did not appear to be credible at the time. But that is all, you know, the kind of stuff that we can discuss either in the academic environment or the newsroom environment, talk show environment. But out in the public realm, for the Pakistani public, any of those explanations are just not credible enough. At the end of the day, there are corpses of innocent people that should never have been there. That is really what is driving the mood in this country right now.
Farhan Bukhari, reporter for the Financial Times in Islamabad, Pakistan, thank you very much for being with us.
Many thanks.
We're talking this hour about Al-Qaeda, American security forces, and the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is Gary Bernstein. He spent 23 years in the CIA. He was leader of the CIA's largest team in Afghanistan during the Afghan War in 2001, codenamed Jawbreaker. His new book is Jawbreaker, The Attack on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, a personal account by the CIA's key field commander. Gary Bernstein, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Nice to be with you today.
It's great to have you. Take us. You were in the CIA for a long time, doing tough stuff in many circumstances, and a lot right here along this same border in Afghanistan. Looking on from afar, you retired last summer. What's your interpretation of the news that we've all seen out of Pakistan from last Friday?
Well, first off, I'd like to say that any time any sort of mission like that is conducted, they're going to be looking at intelligence from multiple sources. There, no one is going to fire missiles based on information from one source. They would have been looking to see if those facilities or if those buildings, that cluster of buildings, had been used over a period of time or possibly multiple meetings in the past. They would have had some recent reporting to indicate it there. If they were using possibly drones, and you talked about the Predator, or if the U.S. Air Force was using the Hawk or others, they would have been looking to see if there were security things placed in the area, guards, all those sorts of things. They're very, very careful about that. And they are, you know, the last thing anyone wants to see are civilian casualties when an effort is made against Al-Qaeda leadership. I participated in things like this over the years, and we took great, great care. But at the end of the day, still, for the United States, Al-Qaeda presents a strategic threat to America. They conducted a catastrophic attack inside the United States in 2001. They've attempted to plan other catastrophic attacks against us. Large-scale bombings in different places in the United States needs to actively pursue them and to try to, of course, decapitate Al-Qaeda's leadership.
Of course, we're left with these headlines, which no one is happy about, and the deaths on the ground, civilian deaths, which no one is happy about. What's your understanding, Mr. Bernstein, of why, after all these now years, Osama bin Laden and his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, are still at large?
Well, first off, it's important to understand that bin Laden had worked along that border area during the Soviet jihad period. He had worked along with Maqtad al-Khidmat, the NGO, non-governmental organization, formed by the Palestinian radical Sheikh Azam.
So he knew it well.
Azam. So he knows it well. And among the 25 million Pathans that live along the Afghan-Pak border, he has a lot of support. He's worked with these people for decades. They will provide him sanctuary as part of a code for their life, livelihood. You know, the Pathans will not turn someone in who has sought refuge. And so bin Laden and al-Zawahiri are hiding in the perfect place for themselves.
Do you think
they have a base of support there?
We've seen the protests, the demonstrations in Pakistan since the attack last week. We know the pressures on the Pakistan government, on Pervez Musharraf. Do you think that Pakistan will ever deliver up al-Qaeda's leaders within their boundaries?
Ultimately, I think they will. They have helped the United States on many, many occasions. Pakistan has a mature view of this. They recognize that al-Qaeda presents a strategic threat to the United States. They have cooperated in many, many areas. They have helped us capture many, many individuals and essentially have aided us in eliminating many of bin Laden's key lieutenants, capturing them, rendering them, you know, these sorts of activities. So I do believe at the end of the day, the Pakistan will step up and do what it needs to do. It is under a lot of pressure. We also have to be very careful about not destabilizing Pakistan, as it is a nation with nuclear weapons.
It's been a long time that U.S. forces have been on the hunt here. We'll talk to you about one key moment when bin Laden apparently got away. Do you take last Friday's attack, the specificity of it, and the expectations of it to mean that the U.S. is getting closer to the top al-Qaeda leadership or not?
I think that we've been hunting him. I know that we've been hunting him continuously. But you have to remember also, they understand we're hunting them. They take special measures. During the Afghan war, during November, we were attempting to capture and kill Zawahiri, and he was traveling around in taxis alone. He wasn't using a bunch of armored vehicles to move from one point to another. He would literally get in a taxi by himself and drive from point A to point B. So, you know, it makes it difficult to use, you know, he lowers his profile to air attack, but he also increases his vulnerability to ground attack when he does that sort of thing. If there are teams of people on the ground, they're trying to attack and kill him.
My guest is Gary Burnson. He's author of the new book, Jawbreaker, The Attack on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And Gary Burnson, I wish you'd remind us of your experience in the CIA and in Afghanistan. What was your background? What was Jawbreaker?
I had entered the Central Intelligence Agency in the early 1980s as an operations officer and would be assigned to the Near East and South Asia division, which handles the Middle East. I would ultimately become a Persian speaker. I spoke Farsi. And would take a series of assignments in the Middle East during the course of my career. I would later in my career serve in Latin America, learn Spanish, and serve there. I had served on multiple occasions and had led, well, I was a chief of station three times during my career, and also I led two of CIA's most important counterterrorism deployments. When our embassies were blown up in East Africa, I was selected to lead that team and participated in capturing those individuals that had executed that bombing. At that point, we learned that bin Laden had gone big. I would then later participate in travel inside of Afghanistan 14, 15 months before 11 September as part of a team attempting to capture one of bin Laden's key lieutenants working alongside the Northern Alliance. And then, of course, after 11 September, I would be tagged by the counterterrorism senator's chief, Kofor Black, to lead the Jawbreaker team, the largest team that CIA had in country during the combat phase of the war.
And what was Jawbreaker's mission?
Jawbreaker's mission was to enter into the Panjshir Valley, work with the Northern Alliance, be that key element for CIA that did liaison with the Northern Alliance intelligence apparatus, and then ensure that we won on the battlefield of the Shamali Plains north of Kabul, and then to destroy the Taliban, to try to destroy bin Laden and al-Qaeda, as much of it as possible. And I did that by having a main team in the Panjshir and then branching out multiple sub-teams into the different provinces in the east. I handled the battlefields of Talakan, the Shamali Plains, Tora Bora, and Logar province.
The Taliban was toppled. Bin Laden got away. How close did your effort come to capturing him?
We were very close to killing him, not capturing him. In mid-November, when the capital fell earlier than we had expected, Mr. Bin Laden fled down into Nangarhar province, that is southeast Afghanistan. I sent a team to pursue him. An eight-man team led by my deputy went into a province that was in complete chaos and had company-sized units of Chechens and al-Qaeda moving about. The team went in. We linked up with a warlord, not a member of the Northern Alliance, a member of what we would create a unit called the Eastern Alliance, would move the team. I would move that team down to the mountains, the White Mountains. We would put a four-man team up into the mountains with 10 Afghan guides, and get over the top of bin Laden and about 1,000 followers that had fallen back with him as he was attempting to escape.
The White Mountains, also known as Tora Bora to most of us?
Tora Bora, yes. Tora Bora is part of those mountains up along the border.
So exactly and how close did that team come?
Those four men could see bin Laden's encampment. We called in 56 hours of airstrikes on those positions in what would become a 16-day battle. Ultimately, yes, that Special Forces team would come in and aid. Delta Force would come in, and on day 11 of a 16-day battle, Delta Force would take command and would finish that. During that process, though, I had called for and had requested the introduction of 600 to 800 Rangers because I knew that we needed to cut off his avenue of escape to the border.
They never came. You call that a major U.S. failure, and you pin it on pretty high-level folks. What was the, why did they happen? Why did that happen? Why didn't they come?
I believe they wanted to kill him with airstrikes. They were not familiar with the territory. It was fast. It was a rapidly evolving situation. And, you know, this is the first time that intelligence officers, you know, since, you know, the days of the OSS were on the ground organizing, orchestrating battles, major battles, and playing a major role in them. I think, quite frankly, for the military, they were a bit surprised and maybe even shocked at how aggressive and how involved we were in directing efforts on the ground.
You expressed major frustration then and in the book that you've just come out about that, about why that happened. Do you think American efforts have improved today, Gary Berntsen? What's the evidence of last week's attack? On the one hand, maybe it's close. On the other, that's a lot of civilian dead and no confirmed leader.
Well, I think that, you know, right away the military understood that they had made a mistake in not inserting ground troops. And in Operation Anaconda, which would be southern Afghanistan several months after Tora Bora, they would introduce troops. We would take casualties there. And since then, the U.S. military has been very, very aggressive, and I think that the coordination process has improved significantly. I mean, this was truly a shotgun marriage of the CIA and Special Forces for the Afghan campaign, and we have gotten better. This is still a very difficult area to operate in. Bin Laden has the support of tribes, you know, among 25 million people living in that area. They are going to continue to assist him and Zawahiri in evading us. Ultimately, I do believe they will be caught or killed.
Describe the mechanics of this for us. The reports today are that this attack was carried out by the CIA using missiles fired remotely, probably by a Predator aircraft. The CIA and not the military? What's the division of responsibility, the working relationship on the ground?
Well, what I can say is this, is that the CIA does have drones and does fly them. They are locked at the hip with the U.S. military. Any of the facilities that the CIA has that handle these sorts of things, they're side by side with the military. The military is in there with them. There are military pilots flying those. There are senior military officers on hand. It's a merged national effort.
You describe both the capacity and the limitations on American clandestine work and intelligence when you were actively involved in Afghanistan. What's your sense today? The kind of intelligence that might indicate here's al-Zawahiri, is that from satellite images? Is that from human intelligence on the ground, from spies in the midst of an al-Qaeda retreat?
It would be a combination. It would be a combination of all of them. They would be attempting to use UMINT, and UMINT is the most important. It would have SIGINT. It would have overhead. It would include all of those things. And I do believe, and to answer the first part of your question, I think that we've improved. I think that Porter Goss, having been a former operations officer himself, understands this process and understands the, you know, a new focus or an emphasis on UMINT, and I think he's doing a good job. I think that the agency is doing those things it needs to get itself back up to speed. We had significant reductions in the 1990s. Don't forget, at one point in the 1990s, 25% of the clandestine service was downsized or was removed by 25%.
You are blisteringly critical of former CIA Director George Tenet. What's the heart of your critique?
Well, unfortunately, you know, you had a president at that point who had no real interest in intel, no real interest in the clandestine service. And in the mid-1990s, the reduction of 25% of the clandestine service injured our national security. People wonder why it was difficult for us to have sources in Iraq, sufficient intelligence to provide President Bush. Well, part of that is the reduction in capability.
You're laying that at the feet of Bill Clinton?
Of course. You cannot reduce your intel service that way. It takes at least 7 years to get a new officer, to get them trained up to speed, you know, 2 years of training in the States, maybe 4 years overseas, plus a language. It takes a long time. It will take a decade for us to get the agency back up to where it needs to be.
And do you think that's underway now, or is that still?
It's underway. It's been underway. And I think that George Tenet understood that after 11 September, and he began the reconstruction at that point. And Goss is going full throttle on it.
But late, says the CIA veteran with us today, Gary Berntsen. His book is Jawbreaker. Jacqueline's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Jacqueline. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. Very good programs you have. I'm really concerned about the whole term war on terror. I'd like to ask your guest what he really thinks about that, because that is really a metaphor. Mm-hmm. And everything that's being done, spying on our civilians and adding so much military to the budget when there are so many things that need help in the country and around the world, why doesn't someone say this is a metaphor, like the war on poverty, the war on illiteracy?
Jacqueline, stick with us. Let me put that to Mr. Bernstein.
That's a good point.
But
that's
stay
a great
with
point.
Us. Yep, Gary?
I would say that this is more a struggle against violent extremism. And this struggle will go on for the next two decades, at least. There is a battle going on right now in the world. And it's not the clash of civilizations of, you know, Islam versus the West. There's a clash of civilizations going on within Islam. It's between those that believe that Islam can coexist with secular democracy and those that want a return to a caliphate, to a return to government like the Taliban had. And we need to be aiding those that believe that Islam can coexist with secular democracy.
Is war the proper word, Mr. Bernstein?
I'm not sure it's the proper word. She makes a great point. I think it's more of a struggle here, a struggle against violent extremism. That's the term I would use. But I do believe that the efforts that the administration are making, you know, this all this discussion about NSA and, you know, the listening on phone calls in the United States.
Tapping of phone calls out without judicial oversight.
Mm-hmm. This is not an effort to create a police state. This is recognition that we are likely to suffer a catastrophic attack in the United States. No one wants to go through Barbara Streisand's garbage. Or some actors, you know, trash in front of their house with their telephones. That's not a concern. People don't have time for that nonsense. What they want to do is identify individuals that could potentially be involved in planning catastrophic attacks on the United States. I know for a fact that the president and those around him are seized with defending this country from suffering an attack, whether it be chemical, nuclear, biological. And they should be, because we slept during the 1990s when we were attacked in Khobar Towers in 1996. Our embassies were blown up in East Africa in 98. Mm-hmm. We had the attack on the coal, and we didn't respond. I think never in history, or very rarely in history, has a great power had such great signals that it was in trouble and did nothing about it.
Gary Bernstein, let me ask you, on balance, since 9/11, have we made progress or given the breeding ground for more terrorists, which very high U.S. officials have acknowledged in Iraq? On balance, have we lost ground?
I don't think we've lost ground. I think people don't recognize that during the 1990s, bin Laden trained more terrorists in Afghanistan than we trained FBI agents in the United States. We have killed many of them on the battlefield. And I do agree.
But not more than we've created, according to General Pace, very high level in Iraq.
I'm not sure about that, you know. I'm not so sure about that, having been someone on the ground that's met with these people, that's worked with these people. I've spent, you know, half my adult life in the Middle East. And, yes, it's complicated. But if we were to, say, for instance, withdraw from Iraq, they would be attacking us in Saudi Arabia and Jordan right away. We have to stand. Unfortunately, this is not a war that we began. The world is too small and too interconnected for us to withdraw.
Do you think bin Laden will be caught? Are you confident he will be caught, or is that?
I believe he will be caught.
How?
I believe he will be caught or killed, ultimately, and he will make a mistake and he will be killed. We are making a huge effort on this. I can tell you from my experience as an operations officer for 23 years, I wouldn't want the agency and the U.S. military working together to hunt me down. No way would I want to be in that position.
Gary Bernstein, do you think U.S. authorities are being forthright about their efforts here? After the Tora Bora escape, which you describe in some detail in the book Jawbreaker, you've got the sound of Osama bin Laden and his crew going down the mountainside on radio. U.S. officials, I think it was General Tommy Frank, said he wasn't there. You say he was. So who is the government being straight up about this effort?
Well, I think, you know, all of that was said in the context of a campaign. Political campaign. I think the government is being straight up about it.
A political campaign, meaning President Bush's re-election campaign.
This was during the re-election.
So he didn't want to take responsibility for the escape. So bin Laden wasn't there then, but now he was.
Well, I think that during that period. Well, let me say this: there are. I guess the best way to say this is that there is confusion sometimes between the ground, those of us on the ground, and the bureaucracy back in Washington. Also, when I returned to Washington, D.C., I had a 30-minute meeting with the DDCI, then was sent off to Latin America. I was never fully debriefed on the details of the operation until 6 to 8 months later by the historical staff.
That hardly suggests a whole new and more effective attitude.
So, I don't think that they understood. I don't think that the administration, nor did CENTCOM, understand all the dynamics of what happened on the ground with the agency teams during the war.
But what about
and they'll, the role... they'll get it now reading my book, of course.
Well, what about the role of politics here? You're very critical of the CIA, saying it was very politically driven, even
yes.
in the midst of the 9/11
yes.
response. The seventh floor driving this, that doesn't
yes.
sound like a whole new and effective attitude.
Well, that was of course, 2001 at that point, but there have been changes at the agency, and I think that Porter Goss has been healthy for the agency. I know that there's been some news reporting about controversy within the agency. I have faith that he is going to strengthen the agency and the clandestine service. I agreed with the 9/11 Commission's recommendation for the creation of a DNI, because that allows one individual to manage up, and it will allow the DCIA now to take care of the clandestine service.
You're saying this is the new Negroponte, the new
yes.
intelligence chief above He's the CIA chief Porter Goss.
Yes, a good man, good recommendation by the 9/11 Commission, and I think it, in the end, will help us.
We heard a lot about how the U.S. appeared to be unable to penetrate al-Qaeda early on. You write about the very critical role, in your view, that Muslim Americans, many ethnically, their families originating in the Middle East, played in this whole effort. How big, how important is that role? What kind of access to al-Qaeda's inner circles through that kind of agent or others does the U.S. have today?
Well, Muslim Americans like German, Japanese, and Italian Americans who stepped up in World War II, Muslim Americans have stepped up in the war, in this conflict that we have now, and they have their service has been fabulous. And without the four men that I write about in my book, we would not have had the success that we had. It was very, very difficult dealing with some of these tribal groups, especially the Pashtun speakers, without native linguists. And those men that served on the ground with us, I'm eternally grateful to them. I think that we have a lot of other officers who are not from the Middle East, and we train them in the various languages and who will focus on the human aspect of our collection, human sources. Muslim Americans are an important part of that, but human remains at the core of CIA's mission. And in the end, we'll play a major part in the ultimate capture or death of the al-Qaeda leadership.
Gary Burntson, author of Jawbreaker, The Attack on Bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Mr. Burntson, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.